Welcome back to Eco Talk, and you are in for a treat. If you've ever had the pleasure of hearing the wisdom of William McDonough firsthand, you know what I'm talking about. If you have not, prepare for a bit of a mind-bending experience, because this industrial designer, architect, rabble-rouser, author, lecturer, and intellectual contrarian, I say that with the utmost respect, of course, has a vision of what is possible that will shake even the limits of what most environmentalists think is possible. He did mine. You might think that he was a dreamer if you didn't know that he has already designed buildings that generate more energy than they consume and factories whose wastewater is clean enough to drink. But he's doing that more, and he's working with the government of China to boot. So we're going to welcome William McDonough to the show and find out what is in store for those who attend the Sierra Summit in a week or two, and also a little bit more about Mr. McDonough's work in China. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
So what is the topic of your talk coming up in San Francisco?
I'm going to be talking about design as the signal of human intention and ask the question, what is our intention as a species?
Good question.
I think we're at that point where we can ask it at that level.
And what does it appear our intention is if you just look at the markers of our current culture?
Well, I think it appears we have no strategy except tragedy. And so I think our culture has become strategically tragic. And any culture that realizes it's strategically tragic is ready for a strategy of change. And so I'll be talking about that strategy of change.
And one of the tragedies, as you talk about, is our cradle-to-grave manufacturing process. What is cradle-to-cradle?
Cradle-to-cradle essentially looks at the idea that if cradle to grave is sort of a linear process that starts with in the world of materials, for example, with raw material, and ends with a landfill or an incinerator. And we not only despoil our landscape and our health and ecological health, but we also lose the value of these materials as nutrients, either biological to soil or technical. As in recycling aluminum or steel.
You talk about you seeing waste in a different way as nutrients and upgrading, upcycling instead of downcycling.
Right.
For those not familiar with these concepts, if you could explain a bit.
Well, what we see today is typically recycling is actually what we call downcycling. The materials are losing quality as they move through the process. So high-grade plastics become low-grade plastics. A good clear plastic becomes something like a park bench or a flower pot. And biological materials don't return to soil, so we're depleting our soils and then poisoning lakes, rivers, and land with materials, or we're putting them in landfills where they produce methane, a highly potent greenhouse gas. So what we're looking at is the idea of everything as nutrition, either back to soil or back to industry forever, and we eliminate the concept of waste. We're not just saying minimize waste and be less bad. We're saying eliminate the entire concept of waste and try to be more good. So in a sense, it's less around trying to bury things and more about trying to reincarnate things.
So if we need a post-industrial revolution, how do we begin to build that?
Well, I think what we've seen is that commerce is really the engine of change, and that business is the fast actor, and that regulatory regimes and guardian kind of activity is the kind of thing the state should be careful about, which is, I think, securing local societies, creating world peace, protecting the environment, things like that, usually chase business in a strange way. And on the world political scene, we see clearly that any nation that is rich in natural resources and quickly taking advantage of them usually has some kind of political regime that's based on plutocracy or hegemony of some political kind. And we see that the resource question becomes a fundamental one in issues of social fairness, environmental degradation, and economic prosperity on a generalized basis. So, we're looking very hard at design models to capture value in all those areas and using business as a change agent and then working on designs that are so safe and healthy and fair and profitable that there's no need to regulate them. So the guardian can celebrate them instead of have to chase them and make them less bad.
Now, I've had the pleasure of hearing you speak at several gatherings environmentally focused, and you always get a standing ovation, and you've said a couple of things that I quote often. This was a couple of years ago. Maybe you don't say it anymore, but how most of what we're doing is sort of shuffling chairs on the deck of the Titanic and eco-efficiency, making a distinction between that and eco-effectiveness. And why is, you know, so much of what we're doing just making it less bad as opposed to good and not only sustainable but thrivable, if that's a word?
Well, I think one of the problems with sustainability per se, I remember when I won the Presidential Award for Sustainable Development, I was at the White House in 1996, and a reporter came up and said, you know, Mr. Sustainable, what does it all mean? And I said, well, you know, what's your relationship to your wife? Because if you said sustainable, I'd say, you know, how sorry I am. Because sustainability, per se, sounds like maintenance. And what we're seeing is a lot of people out there saying, well, if I could be more eco-efficient or treat nature's capital or, you know, things like that, where they start to look at everything as resources and then they can capitalize everything, then you find out that, you know, being less bad is being good in most of these accounting concepts. And so the problem is that, you know, in English language, the double negative is a positive. That the fact is that, you know, boldfacedly, that being less bad is being bad, just less so. And so if we're trying not to be bad, then why couldn't we try and be more good instead of less bad? And so our strategy is not just simply to say be efficient, but be effective. Let's not just do something the right way, because what if it's the wrong thing? You know, so if you're poisoning the world with toxins or you're producing nuclear isotopes that are unmanageable and frightening, or you're producing climate change or carbon in the atmosphere, which is a terrifying thing. And it's even worse now that we understand what's happening in the oceans with the carbon. It's new information, relatively. It's mm-hmm. only been coming out since 2001. But it appears, for example, anthropogenic carbon, that produced by humans, since 1850, the Industrial Revolution, is 84% of it is now in the oceans. And their pH, is the acidity, is at 8.09. And historically, from the Ross Ice Shelf cores, we've seen it's never dropped below 8.2 in 2 million years. And we expect by the end of the century, even with Kyoto Protocol for carbon release being met, it will go to 7.9, at which point calcium carbonate, the structure of a coral reef or a seashell, goes into solution and dissolves. So we are about to dissolve the bottom of the food chain within our great-grandchildren's mature life and young life. This is imminent, and it makes global warming look like a cakewalk.
Exactly, and yet you don't read about this every day. Why is that?
Because people are not paying attention to science on a typical daily basis. It's not part of the daily news. And it took us 20 years to even hear the president say that they understand, you know, he understands, you know, the implications of human activity on climate, and if we just can't take that long for this information to come out. It's only been gathering momentum in the scientific community since 2001. So the information is now coalescing, and so we have an urgent need to address this. But the bottom line is, you know, being less bad won't help us in the end. It's certainly a good thing to do, but it won't change the paradigm. So if you reduce your use of fossil fuels and nuclear and reduction of toxins, you're still in a system that is designed around that framework. And so what I'm working with German chemist Michael Braungart is another system which looks first at the idea of let's do the right thing, which would be in the case of energy, go with renewables. And then let's try and do it the right way, which might mean that we need to be more efficient, clearly, in order to be 100% renewable. Because you would be foolish to try and be 100% renewable around a system that was incredibly inefficient. So certainly efficiency is a great strategy and a critical one. It's just not sufficient to the idea of no end game, that we can play the infinite game of life and not watch it be destroyed by our actions.
So growth can be good if it's done smartly.
Well, if you look at a tree, you know, growth is good, or a child. So the idea that growth is inherently bad is not true. In biology, growth is good. But that's because biology is an integration of the physics of the sun and the chemistry of the earth into biology, which is a living system in which growth is a fundamental precondition. you can't be alive if you're not growing, if you're not using free energy from the sun, and you don't have an open system of chemicals that are operating for the benefit of the organism, its metabolism, and its reproduction. So growth in nature is good.
Hmm. And we just have about 40 seconds left before we go to a commercial break. You'll join us for the last segment, I hope, because I have a few more questions, including about your work in China, and perhaps you're helping them to leapfrog over some of our mistakes. Let's hope so, because we're in this country, it seems, just waking up to doing things a little less bad. And as you've said, that is not going to get us where we need to go fast enough. You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio. We'd like to hear from you. Please go to our website. You can write on our blog or just tell us what you'd like to hear more of and tell us what you think of our show. And our website is www.ecotalk.net. And if you'd like to check out more about William McDonough's work, go to his website, which is www.mcdonough.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
So much and waste so much, how much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? Political pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense.
Welcome back to EcoTalk, and we are having a conversation with William McDonough, who has a great article about him in Newsweek magazine a couple of months back. It was actually the May 16th edition, called Designing the Future, and he is a leading ecological architect, a lecturer, author, and really, you might say a dreamer, except he's actually implementing a lot of these ideas, like putting farms on roofs and really talking about sort of upcycling, not just downcycling, and really envisioning a new industrial future for America and the rest of the world that is more than sustainable, actually thrivable. So thanks for staying with us for the last segment. What kind of work are you doing in China?
We have a whole series of projects in China. I'm the chairman of the China-U.S. Center for Sustainable Development. And my co-chair in China is Deng Xiaoping's daughter, Madame Deng Nan. And she's party secretary for science and technology now. We are working on new cities. We're designing six new cities, probably an average of 2 million people each, based on our book Cradle to Cradle, which has now been published in China by the government as national policy. And the idea is that cities can become assets instead of liabilities, and their waste can become food. And the one of the proposals I just made that we're moving ahead with is that we're doing a whole city where the roofs are all farms. We're lifting the earth up onto the roofs, building underneath, in effect. And we'll be farming the roofs because it's a useful surface that's photosynthetic. So we either make solar energy or we make oxygen and food. And the water that comes out of the laboratories and the showers all goes to water the farms, and the urea from urine and feces, all the phosphates and nitrogen and so on are captured in very effective ways. We're designing new toilets to allow this. It'll be very luxurious and very effective and use very low water because they're using the effect of a lotus leaf to make everything slippery. And it gets down to that level of detail, and it sounds sort of silly, but, I mean, kids love it.
How receptive are the government officials you're working with in China? I would imagine more so than in this country. Did that surprise you?
Well, I think this is just one small vector in a huge supernova of activity there. So I think they're recognizing, you know, the best and worst of modern industrialization simultaneously at very high speed and at very large scale. So, you know, I think that is sort of in everybody's face. Plus, the Chinese have obviously a long history of history. We talk about thinking in terms of seven generations in this country, and I live in, you know, Charlottesville, Virginia, where I was living in a house designed by Thomas Jefferson. So when we realize that we're Thomas Jefferson's seventh generation, and we think that that's a long time, you know, the Chinese think in terms of 70 generations.
Well, so what do they think of what we've done environmentally, ecologically, economically?
Well, I think they're in many senses mimicking what we've done, and they're trying to achieve a standard of living and a quote quality of life that is similar to ours. And they see You know, the way you see that is following the similar frame conditions, which would mean 2% of the population on the land and things like that. I think they're putting the brakes on a lot of that now because what they've recognized is that, you know, we've been able to afford to actually do some environmental protection and cleanup because we've had the chance to take advantage of large imports, cost-effective imports from natural resources from elsewhere, but also we've had this incredible breadbasket sitting in the center of the country. We are still, you know, one of the most highly productive agricultural communities in the world, notwithstanding our various agriculture practices, which, you know, using minerals and causing nitrification, and phosphates are actually one of the largest spreads of low-grade radioactivity. So we are in mineral farming, which is problematic, but we still are immensely productive agriculturally. So the Chinese are looking at all of that, but I think they're recognizing there's probably another path, which involves multi-generational thinking.
Well, we keep hearing about their emerging thirst for oil, catching up with ours, as well as India's. Do you see them driving SUVs en masse?
Well, the funny thing about China is the population is so big that anything they do will be en masse, de facto.
Is there room for all those?
I mean, there's just a lot of people there, and there are a lot of people who want, you know, to be unthinkingly related to timeful issues. So, sure, there'll be a lot of SUVs driving around there. There's no doubt about it. But I think they will also understand that they are driving the world economy. Right now, you know, the fact that typically the United States thinks that China's stealing all the jobs and things like that, you know, is becoming a pretty large question. The fact is, you know, we're sending them the jobs. I mean, if China shut off Walmart for 2 weeks, and or just stop buying our bonds, they could shut down our economy with a flip of a switch. And so, you know, we are in a global relationship. And the way to look at this from my perspective over long periods of time is in the terms of competition. That's why the terms of business are critical. But the word competition is totally misunderstood by most people. It came from the Latin competare, which means strive together and strive. So we're meant to compete in the sense of athletes competing, where we get fit together, and then we compete for fun. So the critical issue is that China and the United States, for example, and India, fit together and get fit together as integrated systems that are coherent and mutually supportive. So that's what we're trying to design into our system. So the things that we can do in China because of the velocity and scale, we'll be able to then import to the United States, which will be a great benefit to the United States. For example, solar collectors. We're looking to drive the price of solar collectors below so they can produce energy below the price of coal, and we expect to have this done within 7 years.
Do you think we need nuclear energy in the remaining 40 seconds of the show?
I love nuclear energy, and I like having it exactly where it belongs in the sun, 8 minutes away. So I think nuclear energy is a key part of our future and always has been part of the history of the planet, but it resides in the sun. And it's 8 minutes, which is exactly how far we need it away.
About 93 million miles away, right where God put it. Keep it there, right?
No way out of the way.
All right. Thank you, William McDonough, for joining us. We'll see you at the Sierra Summit in San Francisco.
Pleasure.
Shortly. If you'd like to learn more about William McDonough's work, and I highly recommend it, as you can hear, he's quite provocative and very intriguing and always fresh, go to his website at www.mcdonough.com. Thanks for joining us. Go out and have a great green week, and we'll see you next time, and hope to see you at the Sierra Summit as well.